Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I was super excited to have Ash Ravikumar. Ash is an accomplished professional in science entrepreneurship with extensive experience in commercializing advanced technologies. He served for 5 years as an entrepreneurship development officer at CERN, where he designed and launched CERN's Venture Connect, a platform aimed at bridging science with industry through standardizing licensing agreements and facilitating spin-outs. He also acts as an advisor to Wilbur, supporting scientist-led ventures in intellectual property strategy and licensing. Ash has held key roles in organizations such as UniQuest, the University of Melbourne, and Honeywell, focusing on technology transfer, business development, and commercialization. Ash's passion lies in material science, IP strategy, and fostering innovation at the intersection of science and entrepreneurship, and he is building Atom Factory to accelerate tech transfer globally. In today's episode, we talk about why science matters. I want to talk about science. Now, this is going to sound like an odd question, but from your perspective, why does it matter how sellotape generates x-rays?
Well, you know the sticky tape that we use, right? Mm-hmm.
Sellotape.
Sellotape, sticky tape, scotch tape, whatever. You know that it's actually an x-ray generator too?
X-ray generated.
Right.
Okay. So how we move from the pursuit of knowledge to the pursuit of application. Often scientific kind of breakthroughs are for the pursuit of the knowledge rather than necessarily the application.
Exactly. Right.
How building Venture Connect with CERN accelerated tech transfer. You spent 5 years at CERN. However, you built CERN's Venture Connect program, and I'd love for you to explain what approach you took to tech transfer, right? Having seen these problems in the universities and in the academic situations you're in, understanding and standardizing the incentivization across tech transfer.
This whole university tech transfer as an industry came about 44 years back.
Mm-hmm. And how to take institutions off of the cap table.
What did you contribute to that race? What did you contribute to the exit?
And why are you sitting on the cap table with 50%, 60%?
Right, leave the cap, even before that, right? If you're not on the cap table, what did I actually do?
How using universities as a distributed manufacturing system will take Atom Factory from producing 1 milligram to 1 kilogram of material and beyond, especially with your distributed manufacturing model, because it sounds like, I mean, like, you know, you're going to be going out presumably two universities as your client saying this is how you should do it. Mm-hmm. And Ash's contrarian opinion, has religion become a net negative to civilization?
I truly believe religion has been a net negative mm-hmm. to humanity mm-hmm. and this civilization.
Let's get straight into it.
This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it.
Ash, really great to have you in the studio with me. Thank you so much for joining me.
A pleasure's mine, mate. Look forward to chatting.
So let's kick off. Firstly, I want to talk about science. Now, this is going to sound like an odd question, but from your perspective, why does it matter and how do we make sure we can make it matter? And after that, I want to talk about tech transfer, right? Which I guess is a modern day phrase maybe for what we would call university spin-outs and still do to some extent. You've worked in universities in the US, Australia, Europe. What are the problems that you see in their approaches to commercializing research? And are those problems common across all the universities, regardless of location, or do some regions do it better? But let's start with that question around science, because obviously that's something you're passionate about.
Absolutely. So for me, science is very universal, right? In the sense that there are only two things. It doesn't matter where you do and who does it. One is science, another one is music. Mm-hmm. You can reproduce everything anywhere. It doesn't matter if Arish does it, Ash does it, or John does it. It's going to be the same. The difference is, when it comes to music, we can all look at music notes and play, but I'm not going to be Mozart. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a Mozart mm-hmm. who's going to compose it, but I can recreate that, yeah. right? Same thing happens in science. And so I worship scientists because they do a lot that I cannot even think and dream about, right? I'm too impatient for science. So where I think the problem is science gets, the equivalent to me is like Sanskrit, right? Nobody speaks speaks it, writes it, talks it, but everything is written in that so that, you know, it's an elite who can read it, right? Yeah. Science publications are like that. It goes to a place where it's paywall to start with, and it's written in two columns, 6 pages for the last 40 years.
And also scientific research papers, like the mechanism by which research papers get boosted is by essentially the number of references that are made to it, not necessarily the quality of the actual work.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So I said that was the original social media, right?
Yeah.
Give me a back citation, which journal does it get published in? And that's the only currency in academia. You want to get promoted, you need to have publications in a high effect journal. So that's the issues with how science is communicated. I always use this, and it stuck to me at an early age. Was, you know, the sticky tape that we use, right?
Sellotape, yeah.
Sellotape, sticky tape, scotch tape, whatever. You know that it's actually an X-ray generator too?
X-ray generated.
Right.
Okay.
So
didn't know.
So when you pull that, you produce X-rays. Oh,
okay.
When it makes that sound.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So that's not a new novel concept. It was found out in 1950s by a Russian physicist, right? When he pulls sheets of mica out, the difference in the energy from those sheets, when he pulled out, you got X-rays out of it.
Okay.
So the postdoc out of UCLA tried it with sticky tape and he found X-rays. So they built a startup around it.
Right.
And found his fund, put money in, this is 15 years back I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
They went to, use case was in defense, built a product, didn't work, the company shut down. But my view is, next time you see a sticky tape after this, you're going to say, that was an X-ray generator, Ashtol, that produces X-rays.
Yeah.
We have a lot of stuff like that in science, but we are still making people memorize equations and go sit in an exam to saying, do you understand science, but not necessarily to understand whether you get knowledge, right? So science for me is beautiful, but we still don't let people enjoy it in a way that it gets stuck.
Yeah, it's become too academic, right? Like it to your earlier point, it's sort of it's the regime of the elites, and whilst it impacts each of us in our day-to-day lives, it's not accessible, right? Like in the same way, and it's often not accessible. It's either super accessible for very young kids watching like, you know, TV programs that kind of try and make science super accessible for a five-year-old. Or you're an academic, but there's nothing in that in between. There's nothing for someone like me who's never going to be a scientist, but enjoys and understands the concepts. And
exactly,
the precepts,
right? Yeah. And for me, there are fundamentally a couple of things that has happened over the years. One, the universal dogma that math is hard, right? Oh, math is hard. Calculus is hard. Where are you ever going to use differential and volumetric calculus? So that gets propagated either by the peer group or what you hear from folks. So once you build that up and saying, well, all of this is useless, I'm just going to do it to pass the exam. And A, we're pushing it on younger kids whose attention is now a lot more distracted, but rather saying, this is beautiful. You need to do this because this helps thing, right? And the extension of that comes in from politicians, you know, people who fund research to saying, why are we doing this basic science? There is nothing that is going to help people. Why are you going looking at what's inside a proton? What's the point?
Or famously in the UK, we're tired of experts.
Yeah. I'm
tired of listening to experts, yeah.
Right. Actually, everywhere, yes. Yeah. But UK included.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, the quantum theory when it was, field theory when it came out, right? Or when they found the electron, nobody had a use for it, right? Now for communications, telecommunications, GPS, satellite comms, everything uses the quantum theory. But if you go back, you know, 40 years and say, this is useless, just, you know, people in Ivory Tower talking about quantum states, yes. But why did they do it? Not because you would have satellites 40 years later, but just because we didn't know what it was.
Yeah. Well, often scientific kind of breakthroughs are for the pursuit of the knowledge rather than necessarily the application, right? Yeah.
Right. So my bias has always been, how do you look at this curiosities and translate them to market faster? Once you close the loop, even, you know, 2%, 3%, it's still progress towards science getting back into it, because there is no two ways about science. There's only one way. You can't refute to saying that, that can't be right, it is. Otherwise, you have to give proof to saying you are wrong, and then that becomes the truth. And science changes, right? Whereas now what we have said is this whole field is just going to be only for a few people to profess to us, and we're all going to step back and ask, okay, you've told it. It's too hard for me. You tell me. And then there's that population is either stagnant or not growing as much. Mm-hmm. We want a lot more people to come and play in science so that, you know, that's what will save us going forward.
Yeah, yeah. And so moving on to that kind of question around tech transfer, like having worked across all these universities, what is the problem? Like in the UK, for sure, you know, we talk to a lot of venture capital partners and funds here on this podcast, but just more generally, if you listen to the discourse around it, there is clearly like a problem around university spinouts in terms of both getting it to commercialization, but then also the structuring of them. We'll talk a little bit about that when we talk about what you did at CERN. But where do you see those? What are the big problems? And do any of them do it better than others, I guess?
Look, so if I take a step back, this whole university tech transfer as an industry came about 44 years back, mm-hmm. right? So in the US, mm-hmm. Bard Oil passed a law to saying that federally funded research outcomes will not be owned by federal agencies anymore, because they found the federal agencies were not equipped with the skill sets or urgency or understanding the market to move those assets. So say like, well, we are not the best place. Mm-hmm. We need to have the contractors, i.e. the universities, own the IP so that they can commercialize. That led to the creation of tech transfer offices. That was 44 years back, right? Mm-hmm. I know the 44 numbers because that's how old I am. Easy math. But what changed, I guess now we have to go back. It's not the spin-out question, but the question, bigger question is, are the universities the right place to take these inventions and commercialize? Do they have the skill set? Can they hire the best people? Do they have the networks to take and commercialize this than somebody else? Yeah. Then if the answer is no, who?
Yeah.
Right? But I think this is the fundamental question to ask, not necessarily the spin out. And I think a lot of the conversation has gone to spin outs. Mm. Primarily because that's the visible one.
Yeah, so essentially the spin out is the symptom of a failing system rather mm-hmm. than the cause, right?
Yeah.
So the cause, to your point, is should we be doing this in the universities in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So my answer is, I guess my thought process, there are two parts, right? There are certain jobs that the university still needs to keep inside. Inventor management, making sure there is no conflicts between who funded it, are there constraints, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of process-oriented one the universities need to keep inside. There's a lot of things outside that they need to tap on expertise outside, mm-hmm. which they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's more, rather than figuring out how much of the value you want to capture, focus on how fast you can get so that you can actually quantify the value.
Mm-hmm.
And most universities across all four continents are still stuck in like, oh my God, we're going to have a value capture issue. We need to be absolutely risk averse on this, cover everything and take time to make it happen. Right?
Yeah, and then someone beats you to it because you've taken so much time.
True. But it's one part of somebody beating to it. The other thing is, why wait 8 months, 9 months, 12 months on a startup, which it might fail based on probability. And especially in the deep tech stuff.
Better to fail fast than
exactly. Let them go fail. If you find a better licensee, brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're having a spin out, ask them to supply to the bigger company, which means they'll get more revenue and you'll get it. Rather than crystal balling and saying, oh, we're reviewing it, it'll take 12 months, write me a business plan. All tech transfer offices require a business plan.
Yeah, which is madness.
And nobody reads it.
Yeah, well, and probably I would assume a lot of the academics that are doing the research don't know how to build one.
Exactly.
Right. And this kind of leads on quite neatly into my sort of next question, which is you spent 5 years at CERN, which is, for those that don't know and have been living under a rock, the European Council for Nuclear Research, best known for the Large Hadron Collider, I guess, in popular science, right? However, you built CERN's Venture Connect program, and I'd love for you to explain what approach you took to tech transfer, right? Having seen these problems in the universities and in the academic situations you're in, and how it differed from those traditional university models that we talked about, and what impact it had on accelerating commercialization. And equally, and I guess this was kind of part of the question, was, you know, one of the large issues, one of the biggest issues we see in the venture ecosystem is broken cap tables, right? Mm-hmm. Which is often due to the equity stakes, the royalty and licensing kind of regimes that these institutions put into the projects. So how did you think about that differently at CERN? How did you circle that square?
Right, so it took 2.5 years to plan, or 3 years to stop the program that we had and launch this. So there was a lot of trauma associated with that.
Okay. So
one of the things, I guess, the unintended consequence of all the venture building accelerator incubator programs that happened was everybody was trying to one up to look as closely to Y Combinator as much as possible.
Yeah.
We had 400 startups at the demo day. They all have combined raised $2 billion, 5 exits, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So everybody wanted to get the same numbers. Mm-hmm. We had 5,000 startups, raised $5 billion, da, da, da. And then the universities were feeling left out in the same metric. And then they started to compete with that, to saying, oh, our startups have raised this much. I've done this, et cetera. My biggest thing was, what did you contribute to that race? What did you contribute to the exit?
And why are you sitting on the cap table with 50% or 60%?
Right. Even before that, right? If you're not on the cap table, what did I actually do? Yeah. Right. And I didn't make friends when I said, it's like my primary school teacher taking credit when I win a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Right. You taught my ABCs, put me to a nap. Thank you. But the Nobel is on me.
Yeah.
Right. So me as a research institute, I am the primary school teacher.
Yeah.
I've got a scientist who's entrepreneurial. I can help with the basics and saying, this is what you need to do. And these are the people you need to talk. And then go, you are going to build.
Not even that, but just giving the space in which they can essentially develop their product.
Or me not being in the middle and blocking them to say, exactly. Oh, you didn't get my permission. You're not going to go do it. Right. Yeah. So that's what I didn't want to do. But I have no control over how the startup's going to succeed, how much they're going to sell, how much they're going to raise, how are they going to exit, right? I can put in a contract to say, you must do it. But if the startup fails, that you must doesn't matter.
Hmm.
So the whole point was, I'm not going to measure any of it. So what do you want me to measure? That was the question. Measure me in time. How fast did I get the contract done? How fast did I get the technology in their hands? And how fast did they introduce to people who can actually help them outside mm-hmm. of their scientific bubble?
Mm-hmm.
So only KPI was time, right? And so we built the whole program to saying, I'm going to give technologies developed at CERN to startups, measure me in how fast I could get the startup, how fast I can give the technology transfer, how fast I can get an agreement signed, and how fast I can introduce to the community of deep tech founders, investors, incubators, corporate venture partners who can take them and help them to go to the next step. We did a few things which I'm proud of. One, we standardized the licensing agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if you're in software, hardware, know-how, no patents, with patents, open source, everybody gets the same deal terms.
Mm-hmm.
Put your name in, use case, sign it, right? So CERN is an international, intergovernmental organization, which means I'm like the UN. You can't sue me anywhere.
Sure.
But their lawyers and our lawyers will say, oh, should the jurisdiction be London or Singapore or California? It does not matter.
It's
can't
irrelevant.
Sue me.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So it's a PDF. No negotiations. Put your name in. And the deal terms, 0% equity, 2% royalty on net sales. But you pay us only when you cross $1 million in sales.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so if you fail at $999,000, thank you for using your tech. Sorry your startup failed. We all move on, right?
But otherwise, it's $20,000 per $1 million.
Exactly.
Which is actually not a huge...
Less than that.
I mean, yeah, well, for sure. Definitely less than that. But I mean, like, but I mean, so then the question to me becomes, what is that institution, whether it's CERN or a university, I guess, right? What is that institution's incentive, right? So it's not a financial incentive, because $20,000 every million is nothing,
mm-hmm.
right? So what is their, is it for the accolade that this technology came out of the institution, or what is in it for them? Because it's not that
fantastic
much.
Fantastic question, right? Because this is where, so let me talk about CERN and then I'll draw the parallelism, right? So CERN is funded by 23 main countries mm-hmm. and 8 associate members,
mm-hmm.
31 countries in total. India is an associate member. That's why I could work at CERN. The operating budget is 1.3 billion Swiss francs a year. Each country pays a percentage based on their GDP.
Which is about $1.3 billion.
Yeah, roughly.
More or less.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah.
Let's make a billion a round number.
Yeah.
Each country pays for their participation in. They pay for it. Taxpayer money goes to CERN.
Mm.
And that money is used to build and maintain the infrastructure, the larger RAN collider on all of it, salaries, for researchers, admin, everything is covered in that 1.3 billion Swiss francs. And that's it. You ask the incentive question, son, all operations is paid for by member states. We are not required to invent.
You're not a for-profit organization, no, as such. Right? Yeah.
We don't. No, I should stop saying we because I finished it, son. CERN does not, there is no mandate to invent. We have to keep the LHC going. We have to probe fundamental particle physics, high energy physics, understand the bigger questions of what is dark energy, what is dark matter, why is there a forces here, etc.
What is a God particle? How do we,
right? Okay, sure. So in the process, serendipitously, we'll invent things.
Yeah, sure.
That was not the main mission. Saying, I need to build this something that takes the particle speed of light. I need better magnets. I need colliders, et cetera, et cetera.
No, but it's big. Yeah, it's as a function of the research, you end up inventing processes or products.
Or that, materials that doesn't exist anymore because it's a very niche use case for us. Mm. Now, we find application outside. We commercialize it. But how much money should I be getting from there? It's not a big chunk that will move the needle on the 1.3 billion. So CERN's view was, I want this to be used by people so that it'll change the trajectory of life rather than me finding out how much money will I get back.
So it's an altruistic mission as opposed to...
Absolutely, yeah, okay. Right? And that's the same thing started with the World Wide Web. So Tim Berners-Lee gave it out as open source. Without that, you wouldn't have Mosaic. Without that, no Netscape. Everything, right?
Yeah.
So now the parallelism to the university. Universities are paid by government grants. The infrastructure is paid by government grants. Land is paid by government grants. They are nonprofit institutions. They're not tax liable. Now, when they come and say, what's the incentive? Why am I missing out on my invention? I'm not getting enough. For me, the question is, should you be getting it?
Yeah.
In the first place.
Yeah.
The comparison always across the pond. Stanford merged $396 million in Google stock, right? Yes, they did. No question. But the problem is, should Stanford have had that 10% equity stake in Google in the first place? Because that was on a PageRank algorithm that didn't include Gmail, Maps, and all of the other products that they built later. And that was not part of the business model of contextual search placement and AdWords, which was owned by Overture. Yahoo bought Overture and sued Google and got 8 million shares pre-IPO, which was about 2 billion. So should Stanford have got 10%? That's the fundamental question. Probably no, but they enable these two PhD students to saying, hey, here's a license, go raise money, build it, because we think it's not going to make money because nobody thought about search would be so big, right? So my long-winded answer is, what's the incentive? The incentive is your inventions are going forward. The incentive is your academics are going to do well.
Yeah.
Incentives is that, oh my God, a professor from University X has created this massive startup, which means your graduates will find jobs there.
Yeah, so it's the, you know, so Ken Robinson talks about it. The big dog, what's his name? Professor Scott Galloway talks about it, right? Academics... So the whole process of education in academia is to create more professors, right? Yeah. Like so essentially what you're saying is the incentive is to boost the reputation of the institution, and they should be happy with that. The equity portion probably is a blocker rather than an enabler.
Absolutely, 100%. Because if you think about it, if I do a curve on risk versus return, right? Let's look at the risk for the three players in there. The university, the academic, and the VC, right? The academic, if they go do go the entrepreneur route and the startup fails, academia doesn't treat them that well, right? And they've got a reputation to lose. And if you're a postdoc, you spend 10 years getting there, you're so close to a academic role, and you're taking a detour, and you come back bottom of the rank to fight it.
And you're probably not being paid a huge amount during that process. So you don't really have the financial security, you know, so if it fails, you got your shirt on your back.
Most postdocs are not, you know, the 21-year-old startup founders, right? They finished a PhD, and they did 5 years of postdoc, which means that's almost 10 years. So if you started at 18, you're 28, some later early 30s, which means you have a family to support. The pressures are a lot more, a lot different. Now, they've got a lot to risk. They're riding everything on it, right? Mm. So the VCs, they put the money behind it. They fail. They can't raise the next fund. Mm. University, they lose IP. Mm. And that's it, right? So, but if you're going to do value capture initially to saying that, oh, these guys are going to, you know, dilute me away, that's probably how it should be. Mm. Because it should look at the risk. If the startup fails, they blow the money, they don't go, the IP comes back to you.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So you've got nothing to lose, but being at a cap table on, you know, double digits
makes no sense.
You know, I mean, when you say 50%, that's ridiculous. But even double digits to start with is too much, right? Because you don't know what they're going to do. You're going to base on something which they tell you, or you're saying, oh, it's an AI startup, so everybody is going to be successful. Where that's where the rent-seeking mentality to saying and the fear of missing out drives them over index on the other side.
And essentially what happens, I guess, if you then sort of bring it back to the venture ecosystem, is that VCs or investors look at that 10%, 15%, whatever the number is, stake on the cap table, that's dead equity, right? Mm-hmm. That is equity from someone who has not really participated in the building of this business, is not really going to provide any, to your earlier point, contacts, connections, value add in terms of the commercialization of the product or the business, but have diluted that down to 85% already. And okay, then there's going to be further out. So VCs will look at that and be like, we're taking the risk here. We're not going to invest because we're going to end up with a situation where the founder holds very little equity in a business that is actually, especially in the sort of fields we're talking about, going to take 10 to 13 years to really kind of commercialize and
100%.
Break through, right?
And so if, you know, and the basic math, right? So if the university, say, owns 20%, right? I'm going to do a seed round. I'm going to get 20% allocation for $1 million.
Yeah.
So it means that your IP is already valued at $1 million, right? Why is that at $1 million where this million is going to hire and do all of that scaling up? That doesn't equate that well, right?
Why have you got 18% for nothing?
Exactly, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
So I reckon there are multiple 16. Ways to look at it, and you know, to saying, you know, where the US has done a lot different, a lot better, quick, fast, lower equities, 5 to 8%. The bigger problem, I guess, is there's a single one size fits all for life sciences and physical sciences. Everybody should stop doing that in tech transfer and saying, okay, life sciences, this is how we license, because the industry knows it. Pharma companies know it. Medical device manufacturers know it, how long it'll take for the regulatory capture. So patents are important. Licensing is important. They'll buy it from or license it earlier, later, et cetera. If you go in the widget world, sensors, software, that doesn't have that big cycle. By the time you get a patent granted, the technology would have evolved a lot more, right? Mm. And that's where the bigger licensing issue is. And since you don't get enough licenses, there's a lot more spin-outs coming outside of the life sciences world, right? And that's where the university should look at it as, let's not block them, let's make them go faster.
Yeah. So you're essentially, the differentiation is between, well, it's the usual atom, well, in this case, atoms versus microbes or cells, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
I guess, you know, just to round off this question, it sounds like this is what is still happening though, right? So the universities have not moved in their position. What is their, presumably they're, you know, they're almost kind of playing the VC game without taking any of the risk, because they're like, well, we incubated this product in our labs. So, you know, out of the 30 that we've, or the, you know, I don't even know if it would be as many as that, but let's say out of the 10 that were happening this year, if one of those get, then we're going to have, like, you know, we're going to have $1 billion on our balance sheet that we can reinvest in endowments and et cetera, right? So I guess the obvious next question is, how do we change that, right? So you're building Atom Factory to accelerate tech transfer and commercialization. So can you walk me through how you're planning to address these issues, especially with your distributed manufacturing model? Because it sounds like, I mean, like, you know, you're going to be going out presumably two universities as your client saying this is how you should do it, I would assume from everything you've just said, you're going to encounter quite a lot of resistance. So like, yeah, tell me how you plan on doing all of this.
Excuse me. So look, what I want to focus on is all on material science, right? So let me start with the problem. The current problem is, since what we talked about, how scientific publication works, everything is geared towards publishing and not necessarily to manufacture, right? The old Bell Labs of the world work because you had fundamental research and a big engineering or applied team together under the same roof where you can invent. And then you say, how are you going to make this, right? That is missing. And I don't think that's ever going to change. Academia is still going to be not on the applied manufacturing side. And that skill set sits somewhere else. Mm. My aim is to say, okay, you've published something. Let's say I've got this amazing material that'll make your batteries charge super fast. But that's a sample of 1 milligram that under best ideal conditions in the lab that worked, but that'll be say 1 millimeter, but I can't make 1 millimeter once, but I need like a continuous process of
production
line.
Yeah.
They don't have that skill set. And most of that will go into news and saying new breakthrough technology coming out of this, which will make your phone's cars charge less than 10 seconds. But it doesn't talk about, well, great, when is it going to hit the market?
Yeah, that's in 20 years' time.
Right. But that 20 years, I've lived those 20 years. I've been waiting for those things, and it's still not there, right?
Yeah.
So the fundamental issue is when you start going and saying, is it designed for manufacture? Do I have the equipment to make it? How do I make it X amount for my initial target customer at the bigger price range for that comment, right? All the early ones will be ugly with warts and everything else before you fine-tune it to get to your final product. All of that doesn't exist in universities, right? So what Atom Factory wants to do is you publish a very good material that you've invented. I want to figure out how do you make it at lab recipe. I need, a chemical vapor deposition machine. I need this. From there, I go take it to a bath to clean it, and then I go coat it with something else. So here's the process. Here's the list of the equipment that I need. Once we figure out what equipment do you need, I want us to look at the universities to saying, university in Spain has these equipments. The university in Edinburgh has this. There's one in Australia that has this. There's one in Canada, right? Send the recipe to them and saying, this is the recipe. Here's the required set of materials you need. Produce 100 samples for a fixed price. Mm-hmm. All universities have something called a service contract or a consulting contract where they can use their machines to produce for businesses.
Which otherwise presumably are sitting idle, right, often.
Or they use for their own lab purposes,
sure.
Right?
But they're not in full time.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a postdoc or a technician who runs it. I know it because all the 5 universities I worked, I used to make these contracts and say, hey, I've got this. Can you put and, get me the diffraction results for it? Great. It's $500 a sample, 10 samples, $5,000. We will give you the IP on the deliverable and the results.
Got it.
Right? So the aim then is for Atom Factory, I'm not spending anything on CapEx because these CapEx are already funded by all of the grants, EU Horizon grants and all the UKRI grants to buy these equipment, which stays in these universities. I am giving them another revenue source to saying, make me 100 samples. The advantages are I remove machine errors, human errors, environmental errors, because I'm going to make this 100 samples each in these 10 universities, which are globally spread out. I collect 1,000 samples from these 10 universities. Now I've got 1,000 samples without any CapEx, and I pay, say, $50,000 per 100 samples. I spent $500,000 to get 1,000 samples. If my lead customer is okay to buy for $500,000 of those 1,000 samples, I've proven that this new exotic material has a use case. People want to buy it at the premium. And every optimization on volume production from there, I can still hit the premium till it becomes commodity, right? Mm-hmm. And so end of the day, how do I want to scale it is to saying, look, we've mapped out all these universities who have this equipment. For me, the inflection point will be the universities that say, hey, by the way, we've got this clean room facility where we can make chips.
We can do something else, yeah,
right?
Sure.
So I put it on the platform to saying, here's all of the 500 equipment that is there in the UK. There are 500 of that in Spain, 500 in Italy, right? Where you can go and saying, I want these processes done. These are the 10, it has to be manual initially. But the early product is early processes to do it manually to get these materials manufactured. We are looking at two materials right now. So from your lab milligrams, I can make up to a kilogram. Mm-hmm. If you want a ton or if you want 100 tons to make it into mainstream, you need hundreds of millions of pounds to actually build the infrastructure.
But if you can get to the 1 kilogram, you can prove out and you can go raise the money to do that.
And the existing infrastructure, ecosystem of VCs and players who know how to do that scale, environmental law, people, et cetera, there's enough and more people.
They exist, yeah.
I need to get to that point to saying, I've de-risked all of this.
Yeah.
It's good to go from there.
Yeah, because otherwise what you have is VCs are taking a punt on the 1 milligram. And exactly. The 1 milligram is not proven, right? Whereas a kilogram, you can start proving.
And for the 1 milligram to a kilogram, you need to spend £3-4 million to actually set up the capital expenditure for the labs.
Yeah, so you don't even have, so it's de-risk massively.
Exactly.
So you do that on a contract basis, it may cost you $250,000, exactly. But it's not going to cost you $3-4 million.
Exactly, right. And so for me, the whole point is, everybody to the point where all of the deep tech is called hard tech. It is not hard, right? It is hard because of these intrinsic problems of the risks involved in it on production manufacturing, because over the last 5 decades, we moved all manufacturing outside of the West, right? And so if you want to manufacture on these high-value goods, you don't have to build massive factories and do it again. We have the equipment already. If you look at it, we as in Europe and the UK, spends close to $80-90 billion in research funding, right? And out of that, half of it is for infrastructure, right? Wow. And I spoke to one of the scientific instrument manufacturers, sales guy, and he said, we know this equipment is $500,000, but none of the grants allow it for $500,000 in the for the infrastructure or equipment, equipment allowance. So we give a quote for $250,000, and the other $250,000 is on maintenance that we'll get after the grant is done, right? And so it's an industry because a lot of these new microscopes, new vapor deposition machines and all of it, the biggest customer is academia, right? And so that's where that infrastructure already exists. How do you tap on that to make it a little bit useful?
Yeah, so you're almost creating a market. It's a decentralized marketplace for manufacturing, right? But for small scale manufacturing to go from that milligram to that kilogram, but in a way that A, taps into existing resources, an income stream for the universities that have it, and obviously provides an opportunity for the postdoc or the research, the researcher at the university or even the entrepreneur to be like, okay, I like this technology, but I need to, and I can sell this to a VC, but I need in a lower risk way, I need to be able to prove this out before going out and trying
absolutely
to raise
and that and at the de-risk point, you don't actually need to do a startup either, right? You go to Doe or any of the big chemical companies, DSM, whatnot, and say, hey, here's a recipe. You've got 100 ton capacity to make it. I've got a customer who bought it at this. Can you make me a ton?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They can scale, and because they've got the infrastructure already, right? Because if you have de-risked it and saying, okay, I'm not going to put a unproven tech into a big production plant to make it. Now, I've got a small pilot that you can do.
Yeah, they're more likely to do that if you've proven it out than if you just turned up.
Exactly,
and said,
right?
I've done it for, this minuscule quantity. Can you now scale that up to 100 tons?
Right.
Yeah. I think it's a super interesting idea. I mean, the thing that strikes me is, why has it not been done already?
Okay, so the people...
What's been the barrier?
The people in the know how to leverage academia for it, right? So... For example, in Australia, a lot of the mining companies used to come and do it because A, I didn't have a chemist who was available to do this particular nuclear testing, right? And saying, oh, look, we're getting copper out. These have some nuclear nucleotides and copper. Can you do a test on the rock sample and give it back to me? Mm. Now, all the big mining companies have their own in-house because they did a lot of mining and they needed their own faster turnarounds, right? But the infrastructure, the whole reason why governments fund universities to have this equipment is because then this is a public institution which will have it for public good, right? Understandably, some professors have a big lab and they've got, their own priority to build and use what they have to do, and it'll be one machine for the entire department, and they already are fighting to manage the time for it. Totally understand. But we always look at the global minimum and not the global maximum, right? So if your professor at your university doesn't have access to that equipment or can't give you access,
someone else somewhere else does.
Will, right? Yeah, and so I still remember when I was in grad school, I couldn't get access to it. I emailed a friend who lived in Mexico. I was like, yeah, don't worry. We'll get the test done and send you the results. I didn't have to do it. Here's the list of things that you want to do. This is the results I want, right? And does it correlate? Can you do a test? I'll send you the sample. I'm like, sure, no worries. I'll do it in 2 days and send it back, right? Which meant that it was faster way to get correlated my results so that I can move on, right?
So this comes back to your point around speed versus...
Exactly, right? Man, I'm impatient by design. Anything I can do faster, I want to do faster. Right? And so the other issue is, if you ask me what's my ultimate goal, is to have like a tool shop, like a Skunk Works, where academics can come open up a machine to saying why it works, how it works, right? Small digression, but I'll come to a point. Professor Shuji Nakamura, he is Nobel laureate in physics for inventing LEDs, which gave us blue LEDs, which gave for all the color LEDs that we use now. But his backstory, really quick backstory is, he was using the CVD machines, vapor depositions, to put these different materials, indium, gallium, arsenide, and all of it growing. It can never work, right? And each of these machines are $5 million. And so he really wanted a PhD. He was working for Nietzsche, and so he went to University of Florida to look at these machines so that he can do a one-year sabbatical. But when he went there, the machine came late. All he had to do was wait. And when the machine came, he could never run it, but he arranged, put together the entire machine. By the time 12 months was done, he was back in Japan. Then he went and hustled and got $5 million to buy his own, but it still didn't work. But since he knew how to build the other machine, he says, that's because the machine is not doing it properly. It's got only one flow. So he took the machine apart, added a second flow, and that's how he built it.
Okay.
That nobody else could do it, right?
Because no one else had to build the machine. And.
But if you're a PhD or a postdoc and there's a $5 million equipment there, you're not going to open up and see what's inside. You'd be like, have a window, press the button and watch it build, right? But that's the problem. You need to tinker to saying, this is not doing what I want to do. What if I take it and bend the nozzle to do this? Oh, no. Think about the liability, the insurance, what will happen to the serviceability and all of it, right? Whereas if it is, here's a machine, opened up, this is how it works. You break it, no worries, we'll fix it. Come play and tinker with the machine so that it'll do what it has to do for you.
For you, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that is a bigger roadblock on why a lot of these materials don't work, is because I don't know what happens to that machine and I'm too scared and I'm not allowed to open up and fix it. I'll be my ultimate goal to saying, here's the 10 equipments that we use regularly. Open up, hack it to do what you have to do.
Yeah. It makes me laugh because it takes me back to my days in manufacturing where, our engineers would constantly be tinkering and I'd be like, no, but if you, no, it's fine. We'll do this. It'll make the foam come out bigger or, more compressed or whatever it was we were trying to do, or the plastics will come out thinner or whatever. And so much of it is around to that fine tuning, as opposed to, you don't buy a piece of equipment and just expect it to run exactly how you want it to. And certainly in the environments that I was manufacturing in, which were like, Papua New Guinea, very poor power supply, very humid, very hot, like all of these things have an impact on the equipment, right? If they're not in an environment where it's steady state, and therefore you have to be able to tinker with them to get them to do what you want to do. This is not an area of life that I am, that I've been heavily sort of aligned with. Although, as I was saying to you, we're talking to a number of businesses at the moment that are in this sort of material science space, and I'll show you a video offline, maybe in a little bit. So one of our clients is creating synthetic leather out of mycelium and algae. And they've just set up their first plant, which is now running in Oxfordshire. Apparently things are going quite well. So it's very exciting to see it go from the lab into sort of production. And you are essentially that bit in between. So you are the step between that $50 million plant and the lab in the university, right? So I have one final question for you, Ash, which is something I ask all my guests. And so far with interesting results, we have some people who come back and tell me immediately what their thoughts are, and some who are, if not reluctant, slightly, you know, find it slightly hard. And I can understand why. But what is one thing that you have a contrarian opinion on or conviction on from any area of life, whether that's work, life, politics, or socially? What is the hill that you would die on defending?
I thought about it, and I was back and forth on should I say it out loud, but F it. So from my view, I think I truly believe religion has been a net negative to humanity and this civilization. And I'm a strong believer there was a much more developed civilization before us, and we seem to have lost the evidence of it. We've got some landmarks left of the pyramids or Angkor Wats and all brilliant, beautiful, Indian architecture.
Incredible construction and engineering.
Right, yeah. which now with our equipment, we would struggle to do or replicate it, right? Sure. So there was something there, and then something really bad happened where we are. Now we are still struggling to fix a lot of it. Primarily for me is why I call it a net negative is that all Abrahamic religions or Hinduism, which I was born into, all believe in books, which are static documents which are written, which are not updated. I hope sooner or later that we look at it, religion as a whole, to make sure that it is adapted as we progress, right? It seems to be the ball that's dragging us down, not letting progress because of, well, this was how it was 2,000 years back and we wrote it down and you can't break that sacrosanct rule.
Yeah.
Seems a net negative.
Yeah. So dogmatic belief, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And we also know that even in science, dogma is anathema to science, right? Like when you become dogma, I mean, this is why, you know, the earth is round. Well, no, it's flat. It's spherical. Yeah. No, it's flat. Yeah. We know it's flat. It's been flat forever. Yeah. It's always been flat.
Yeah.
And, you know, took centuries for people to come around.
And they kill people who didn't agree.
And essentially also held back breakthroughs as a result of understanding that the world is round and that it is spherical and that it moves around the sun as opposed to everything moving around it. No, look, I mean, as someone who is spiritual but not religious, I absolutely, you know, I think I could subscribe to that contrarian opinion. I don't think it is that contrarian, to be honest.
So for me, I guess where the fight goes, and when I said it to people like, are you atheist? I'm like, no, I'm not an atheist, because they are more on the other side calling everybody wrong, which is also not helpful. I'm not agnostic, but the view that triggers is everything ties back to, you know, any religion or any belief system is to saying this is core and this is what it defines us.
This is the codified
way to live, or ascribe or prescribe to, where, you know, if collectively we're saying this is actually not helping or progress, what if we let go, right? I'll quote Ricky Gervais on it, and, you know, in one of the interviews, they asked him, well, science is also faith. How do you know the universe is expanding or contracting?
Yeah, right? I love that. I remember, yeah.
Right? And he said, like, true, it is a faith, but there are evidences to show whether this is true or not. And he finished by this and said, say we burn all the books, right? 2,000 years later, the science would be still the same. I don't think the religious books would be the same.
Yeah, I think what he said was, you know, if we burned all of the books,
all fictional books,
all the books, and started again, you wouldn't end up with a Bible, but you know, someone would again prove the laws of, you know, Newton's three laws of motion, etc. Right? Like they are indisputable rules around how the world works and can be replicated. The other quote I love of his, and not to digress too much, is, you know, when someone asks him, but you're an atheist, you don't believe in God. And he goes, well, hold on, but you're a Christian. Yes. Okay. So I just don't believe in one fewer God than you do.
Exactly.
Which I just think is a lovely way of putting it, right? Anyway, listen, Ash, it's been absolutely incredible talking to you. Thank you so much for joining me. For our audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where is the best place for
LinkedIn,
them to
Twitter works. The landing page of Adam Factory should be up soon, and I'll put it in the link notes once it's up and running.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure's mine, mate. Thanks.